From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, our Real Talk series continues with a look at debt, wealth, and gender. Plus, we'll look at the state's program designed to help people save for college. Later, director and Milwaukee native George Tillman Jr. on the remarkable child actors in his new film.
These kids, even though they were 13 and 8 years old at the time, they understood and was passionate about the movie and put every ounce of energy and talent and guts into the movie that they had.
And a documentary looks at Wisconsin research into the science behind meditation.
Modern research is teaching us that there are functional as well as structural changes in the brain that arise as a consequence of different kinds of meditation practice.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The latest census figures paint a pretty bleak picture for Milwaukee. About 27% of its residents are living below the poverty line. That's defined by the federal government as having an annual income below $23,492, or $64 a day. But that's for a family of four. It's even less for a single non-custodial adult. We've been talking about poverty versus wealth with the help of the UWM Associate Professor of Social Welfare, David Pate. He says these stats are concerning because of how hard it is to get out of poverty. A person on the brink is often unable to attain any assets to draw upon in an emergency and then starts to rack up debt. Debt, he says, that's almost impossible to get rid of. The situation is especially dire for the city's black men, he says, who accumulate a disproportionate amount of debt. To help us put the situation in context, he invited Ann Price from the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative for this edition of Real Talk with David Pate. Pate tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why he thinks we need to talk more about why many black Milwaukee men struggle to accumulate wealth and go into debt.
Black men or black families have been, since we started keeping data on who's poor in our country since 1959, have historically, black people have been at the bottom, historically. As more people have come into our country, from Latinos to Asians, you still have found that black families are at the bottom. Why black men? Because in a city like Milwaukee, where 41% of the people are poor, that doesn't even take into account men, because we don't really have good data on men separately. We have really good data on women. But when you do some work that I've been doing over the last 15 years, you will find that these men have special circumstances that account for them being further impoverished than women, that I think are really unique and really important to talk about, particularly in a city like Milwaukee and particularly in Wisconsin.
What are these factors that are impacting how much debt black men are carrying in our community?
The one thing that really affects black men, and this is across all strata, with an education or without education — without education, you definitely don't have the opportunity to basically be employed. With an education, we're still seeing with new data that black men are still underemployed based on their education level. So for men in Milwaukee, where you have about a 40% dropout rate and people are not graduating, that makes a big issue for them around who's going to employ me, when Wisconsin as a state is like number one or two in the country for graduation rates. And so black men look very different. The other issue is that there's the home ownership issue is a major indicator of whether or not you're able to have any accumulation of wealth. And we talked about that last time. But many of these men don't have any housing to benefit. Another factor is that if these men experience any problems, there's really not a safety net for them, particularly without any children in their care or children in their custody. So the only benefit they can really get is food stamps. If you're a man who's having any kind of major challenge to economic security, there's no real safety net to help you get through that particular challenge. And with a study that came out recently, Wisconsin has the highest rate of black male incarceration. And so if these men are being incarcerated, there's a record that follows them. It's harder for them to get employed. So we have a number of things that are problematic for these men.
And is this something you're seeing on the national level?
Well, what we're seeing across the nation and what we've seen historically are unemployment rates that are nearly double for blacks than they are for whites. And that's been pretty much a longstanding part of our American history. There are only a few years that the rates were not double. So it's been a phenomenon that we've lived with for a very long time. And when you really take a look at what's happening in Milwaukee specifically, you can see a real steep decline in employment opportunities for black men, particularly past the 70s and 80s, when jobs were more plentiful, when there were particular types of jobs that men who had lower levels of education could get that have now dried up and disappeared. But even men that have a college degree tend to have unemployment rates that are nearly double their white counterparts. And when you really look at what's happening in Wisconsin, you see that, you know, some groups are really flourishing. You know, there are amongst white males, unemployment is very low, and employment rates are nearly at what we would call full employment. And that means basically anyone that wants a job can almost get a job when you see unemployment rates as low as like 3.5%. So there's something very peculiar that's happening that diverges from what's happening nationally in Milwaukee. And what we're seeing is really very limited opportunities for black men. I just want to add to that by saying that, you know, Milwaukee has some of the lowest employment rates of black men in the country. I think maybe Buffalo and Detroit may have lower levels, but certainly for prime working age men, there's a real issue with employment. And I think a lot of that has to do with the school system. It has to do with the relatively segregated neighborhoods that exist in the city, cutting off men from opportunities because of transportation just does not exist for them to get to the kind of jobs that would give them kind of living wages for their families.
Yeah, and what I think is so interesting, too, about what you just said is the unemployment rate for black men in Milwaukee is two or three times higher than most white men in the city. But also for many of the black men in this community that I talked to about the intersection of employment and a previous incarceration record. And then there was a study where they looked at employment and incarceration, and still white men were hired over black men with the exact same record.
So it seems like obviously one of the big barriers to getting out of debt for black men is this lack of employment opportunities. But what is it about this debt, other than just maybe not having enough money, enough income, that's making it so hard to get rid of?
You definitely need some type of asset to help you not only weather storms, you know, economic setbacks like unemployment, but also to provide some opportunity for your children. And what we're talking about here is not just the very well-to-do being able to provide opportunity. You know, people want to, you know, see their children rise above their own economic station. So even if you don't have, you have limited means, you want to see your children go beyond where you were able to go. And so without the ability to draw upon any kind of savings to use your home equity to finance your children's education and do a host of other things, you really find yourself just trying to scrape by and kind of living from paycheck to paycheck, which many Americans are experiencing. But I think in this case, when you're looking at a city where men in their prime working years were seeing gaps of 32% between blacks and whites, signaling that something is fundamentally wrong. And so without the ability to have income, you know, it makes it very difficult to accumulate assets. It's hard to put money away. You're not putting money away. You're using it for all your basic necessities. You're not able to purchase a home. For many of the men, and one issue that really affects men in Milwaukee is a lot of them don't have driver's license. And that gets back to the thing that I was talking about in terms of being separated from jobs when there's no public transportation. The rate of men having their licenses revoked is particularly high in Milwaukee. So these things keep men from having anything to be able to give to their children. And you need those assets to kind of propel yourself, propel your family and your children into a life that's economically stable.
I did a focus group this morning, and I was talking to the men about what is one of their biggest challenges. And one man said, I just want to be able to send my kids to college and use my house to do that. It's something I'm able to do. And it makes a big difference for my kids to be able to have this, what I need for them to be able to take care of themselves. But I think the whole idea of having an asset of some type is what they're not able to do. So they're perpetually in debt. And also for many black families who are not married, and because we have a high rate of poverty, and in poverty, you know, in the city of Milwaukee for black families is at 29-30% federally. And so with that much poverty, and also you have that much single parenting, you have this issue called child support, which we could bring up as one of their major debts that these men confront. And they don't understand how it works. It has an interest attached to it, much like a credit card. And when you have rates of unemployment for black men in a city like Milwaukee that range from a low of 30% to a high of 70%, depending on the neighborhood, that causes these other problems for them. and makes it much harder for them to be able to accumulate wealth.
And you had mentioned before, David, this idea that we lack a safety net for Black men that does exist for Black mothers, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, the safety net, you know, the safety net exists not just for Black mothers, but for women or parents who have children. That's the way our government sets up. So there's somewhat of a social welfare system that we decided in 1935 that we wanted to be sure that people were okay if they had a challenge. Over time, poverty, as it's defined, has increased. And so for men, even if they may have a child in their custody that's not their legal custody, maybe their physical custody, there's nowhere they can go. All single women, all single men have this issue, white, Black, Latino, Asian, all people who are single, if they are poor. They have no person they can go to. I think of the story where a young guy told me, a young white guy said, I was out of a job, I got out of the prison, but my uncle gave me a job at the gas station. And I'd have the same story with a Black man this morning who said, I got out of prison and I was on the street. My family didn't have any place. I couldn't stay there because they would have lost their housing if they found out I was there because of the way the social welfare system laws are. Or my family was really tired because they really couldn't handle another person in the house. It's just a very different story based on your race and also whether or not you're someone who has to use the social welfare system to deal with your daily needs, which is very different. Many people who are in this city, and when you have, again, such a high rate of poverty, there's not many resources you can fall back on, which are part of your social wealth safety net. You don't have that safety net.
Where do we start when all of these issues, the unemployment, the debt accumulation, the lack of assets, the lack of community or even governmental support, what do we do when all of these issues are so complex and so interconnected that they almost create a vicious cycle in our communities?
One of the things that we have to do and what we're trying to do in our work together mm-hmm. is really tell a story that really shows the interdependence of some of these issues and how kind of a series of events can happen that really cause men to spiral downward. And the intersection of kinds of practices and policies that are beyond the man's control really feed into their poor kind of economic prospects. And so, you know, David just mentioned, for example, that, you know, if you've ever, you know, been convicted of a crime, you cannot be in public housing. And for some of these men who may have gone to jail simply because they couldn't pay child support, they're barred from living in certain housing. It puts them right on the street. So there's the intersection of when this happens, there's a sanction. That sanction causes someone to go to jail, lowering their prospects for ever getting employment, you know, and also pushes them out of other systems which they're barred from. They're barred from all sorts of jobs that exist because they have the criminal record. They're barred from housing. And so you see how the interplay of these issues and how they impact people's lives. We need to move past kind of simplistic thinking and solutions. So much of our focus is on behavior and saying, well, gosh, if people just made better choices, if they just had done something different, if they had just done X, Y, or Z, and not really taking into account that even and sometimes despite someone's behavior, that these policies and practices are in play that have a very detrimental impact on their future. You know, does it make sense to kind of penalize folks, causing them further economic insecurity when we could actually be doing a lot more to help them get a leg up? So we have to be more thoughtful in our policy solutions and much more comprehensive.
And also, it's a community effect. I mean, we all are affected when someone is not given an opportunity to do better for their children and do better for themselves. And I think that's what we're seeing with these men in Milwaukee. What I tend to see is a lot of them really want to do really good things with their families, but based on a previous choice that was a bad choice, they can't move further. And I think that's a problem for all of us because then it becomes more of a burden for everybody. You know, when you look at a prison system that costs $33,000 a year to incarcerate someone when that could be a job training program, that would be something to think about. So I think that there are some solutions that are out there. They're very new. This discussion is very new. But it's something I think we've just finally come to understand that maybe the American dream is not attainable for everybody based on just the fact that you were born into this very poor, impoverished situation.
Ann Price, David Pate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
David Pate is associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. He's founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice and our Real Talk contributor. We also spoke with Ann Price from the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative at the Insight Center in California. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Their October conversation will look at the connection between debt and child support. Wisconsin works to encourage more people to save for college. We'll learn how when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The latest Wisconsin economic scorecard is due out later this week. It's the quarterly snapshot of how people feel about the state's economy and their own finances. One area that concerns many economists is the rate of savings in this country. Americans held on to more money during the Great Recession, but savings rates have been going downward ever since. In Wisconsin, the state is trying to encourage more people to put away money for college. And the threshold for investing in the state's 529 plan has been lowered in recent months. Jim DiIulio is Wisconsin's 529 College Savings Director, and he's with us in the studio now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Good deal. I'm happy to be here today.
What is the significance of a 529 plan versus any other way of saving for college?
You know, saving for college is something that all families think about. 529s have only been around about 15, 16 years now. And what they can do is they offer a lot of advantages. There's professionally managed investments, a number of tax advantages, both federal and state. And then, of course, being they're so large, people can take advantage of institutional pricing, which means that you as an individual can invest at fees much, much lower than you could just as a single person.
There are state-specific plans. Each state is allowed to set up its own version of the 529 plan. There are two in Wisconsin. If I understand correctly, though, people from outside Wisconsin can choose to invest in Wisconsin's plans, and likewise a Wisconsin resident could choose to invest through another state's 529 plans. So what is it that distinguishes what's available in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, you're correct there. There's about 80 plans altogether across America, and you're actually free to invest in any of them. But there is kind of a state advantage because these are actually state-issued securities. And states that have income taxes, such as Wisconsin, also have benefits for their state residents. For example, here in Wisconsin, you can claim a tax deduction of up to the first $3,000 for each student each year into the account that you wouldn't be able to get from, say, the Iowa plan, which also has a tax deduction for their residents.
How has Wisconsin's 529s, this is Ed Vest and Tomorrow Scholar, how have they evolved over time?
You know, we've only been around, like I said, 15 or 16 years now. But between both plans, we have over $3 billion, with a B, and more than 200,000 families saving, most in Wisconsin, but actually some all across the country. People find that we've had good selections and low fees.
Well, and along those lines, have things changed in terms of the threshold it takes for someone to start one of these plans?
Well, you know, at first, you know, we were all kind of trying to feel our way here, but sometimes the obstacle is it just takes a little time to get started. And just recently, last October, we decided to drop the price of admission, if you will, to $25 just to get an account open. No obligation. You can add to it. Now, obviously, $25 is not going to get you to college. But if nothing else, at least to get you started on the path. You know, savings is a kind of a regular habit. You can set things up where you can have money automatically drawn out of your checkbook or your credit union account every month or twice a month if you'd like. There are a number of employers that have also set up payroll deduction, which is also very handy to do.
Well, and so do the math for us. What does it take to make a significant difference? How quickly do things add up? And why do this versus just, you know, put the money under a mattress?
Well, the one that gets everybody excited is the tax benefits, because as long as the dollars are used at the other end for higher education expenses, and that can include anything, tuition, room, board, books, lab fees, all that sort of thing, there are no federal or state taxes due on the growth. So, I mean, that's a significant savings both with federal and state income taxes. And then at the same time, you can also get a deduction here as a Wisconsin resident by putting money in. So everything else considered, it's a very, very efficient way to save money.
What, if any, are the risks in this kind of investment?
Well, you know, and risk is his thing because obviously you can invest in the stock market. And are things risky? Yes, you can lose all your money. But that's just like in a 401k or whatever. The trick is to moderate your risk and to kind of know what your tolerances and things are. A lot of times as you get closer to college, you want to start putting your investments in more bonds and more stable investments there to kind of lock in what growth you've had. But a lot of times when your kids are young, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, you can afford to take some risk in the stock market, same as you would in a retirement plan if you're 25 or 30 years old. So it's like a retirement plan only compressed into maybe 10 or 15 years or so.
Well, and so how much manipulation, if you will, do you have to do when you open up an account? I mean, is it as simple as just starting with $25 or $50 or $100, or once you get to that point, you know, what are your options?
Well, you have a lot of choices. In our AdVest plan, we have over 20 different selections. You can be in very simple guaranteed interest investments or CDs of the bank. You can also get into a variety of mutual funds type of investments. One of the more popular ones is what they call the age-based tracks, and these are actually automatically changed every couple years. And so we have professional investment people that design the portfolios, a mix of stocks and bonds and cash. And every couple of years, they get a little more conservative as the kids get closer to college.
There's been some criticism in the investment community since the 529s came along about, as you say, 15 or 16 years ago, about what's known as the expense ratio versus in some other mutual funds. What are we talking about when we hear that term? And where does a program like AdVest fall in that ratio?
Well, that's the thing I was talking about, the institutional pricing. Because all investments have some sort of overhead fees because somebody has to design the portfolio and buy and sell the stocks. Even index funds have to have those things. And what we're allowed to do with a program like AdVest or any 529 plan is we work on a really large numbers. And so if you think about it, we have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest. And so we get the same type of pricing that, let's say, a foundation or some sort of endowment would get. So actually the cost of investment is probably in most cases less than 0.5%, 0.25% for everything, which also includes some of the overhead, you know, to pay for mailing the statements and doing that sort of thing. And there's some legal things we have to file.
Talk about the actual process for opening an account. How can someone actually get going on this?
Well, an account has two parts. There's an owner, and then there's what they call the beneficiary. And the owner is usually an adult, and oftentimes the parent or a grandparent. It doesn't necessarily have to be that, but just an adult. And then the beneficiary is a potential student, and you have to have Social Security numbers, and you can set it all up. Now, the question always comes up, well, what happens if my kid's not going to go to college? Well, 529 rules are very family-friendly. Let's say that one of your kids decides not to go to college for a while. You can certainly take that balance and transfer to another beneficiary. And that pool is large, too. In addition to other kids in your family, they can include cousins, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, just about anybody that comes for Thanksgiving dinner.
But you cannot at this point invest on behalf of a hypothetical kid down the road.
No, you can't, because obviously there has to be a Social Security number and something. But what sometimes the people do is you can also use a 529 account for yourself, because let's say you want to take some additional classes or further education. And there have been cases here and then where maybe someone wants to take advantage of a tax deduction before the end of the year, but the baby's not yet born. So you can actually open an account in your name with as the owner and beneficiary. And then when your son or daughter is part of your family, you can just change the beneficiary at that time.
You are an employee of the state of Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
So explain, what is the state of Wisconsin's relationship to the two programs? I know you oversee them, but as the state of Wisconsin, what is the state's responsibility to the people that invest in these programs and the programs themselves?
Okay, this is a little bit of inside baseball here, but but technically 529 plans are what they call municipal securities, and these are the siblings of municipal bonds. That allows us to give the state tax break. And the entire program, though, however, is self-supporting through the small amount of fees we charge to people. So there are no tax dollars used in this program at all. All the dollars are there for the benefit of the owners and the beneficiaries of the plan. But then the state, of course, supervises things. We're just finishing up our audits right now, and we have outside auditors and other experts to obviously keep everything legal and properly posted, and we'll have the audits posted on our websites coming up here in about a month or two.
And do I understand, is there's some relationship to Tia Cref, is that right?
Yeah. Every state usually partners with some sort of a commercial entity, and TIAA CREF has been around for a long time. They're really active in the retirement business, and Wisconsin is one of the 11 states where they manage the program for us. And we have a wonderful relationship with these folks. They do a lot of the record-keeping things for us. And then again, by working in a number of other states, there's some economies of scale when we go out and we need to buy advertising services or internet services.
Jim DeIulio, thanks so much for giving us the lowdown on 529s, if
you will. Well, good. We're happy to be here. And you can follow us on Facebook at EdVest, and we also are on Twitter. And both of those sites also include some really good tips here for parents planning for college and that sort of thing, too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Jim DeIulio is the 529 College Savings Director for the state of Wisconsin. You'll find a link to more about the state's EdVest program at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and then we'll talk with director, producer, and Milwaukee native George Tillman Jr., who's being honored with a tribute at this year's Milwaukee Film Festival. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Film Festival is underway. In addition to screening more than 200 films, a hallmark of the 15-day event is the tributes that are paid to people, directors, writers, actors, critics, people who have made contributions to film culture as a whole. Yesterday, we spoke with two members of The Dissolve, a Chicago-based online film criticism and pop culture magazine. They were being honored at the festival. Today, we'll meet Milwaukee native George Tillman Jr. Tillman has directed and produced numerous movies, including Soul Food, the Barbershop series of films, and Men of Honor. Tillman will screen his newest film, The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete, which premiered earlier this year at the Sundance Film Festival. The movie was written by another Milwaukee native, and it tells the story of two young boys forced to fend for themselves one summer in Brooklyn. Tillman talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North from his office in Hollywood, and he reflected on the movie, which is making its Midwestern premiere here.
It's a really beautiful, great story. It's a story that you never really see that much in film or on television. It's a story that goes untold. The script came to me around 2009 in February, and when I started reading the script, I fell immediately in love with the material. And then I come to find out that the writer is actually from Milwaukee himself. His name is Michael Starberry. He's a writer that grew up in the Hillside Housing Projects in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that he was now living in Minnesota. So that really sparked my interest to really read the material. But it's this beautiful, beautiful story about two young kids who didn't know each other very well. One is 13-year-old African-American kid, and one is an 8-year-old Asian kid, and their mom abandoned them during the last day of school. And it's really about these two kids who have to become friends, who have to rely on one another, to survive a really hot, long summer in the Brooklyn projects in Brooklyn, New York. And they have to survive without any electricity, without any food, and they have to dodge the housing authority police so they don't get put into the system, which could lead to foster or being in juvenile system. So it's really about these two kids who have to survive with one another and their relationships and how we need other people in our lives. And I thought that was just a beautiful story, and I wanted to tell that as a director.
For Mister, who is the older of the two, you know, it's about his dreams and what he thinks he's capable of. And that's often a story we don't hear or see either.
Yes, you know, and the interesting thing is the movie is told through the eyes of this kid. And no matter how many obstacles that is thrown in front of this kid, I mean, these guys have to survive every day. And there's a lot of obstacles that come at them. But they keep moving forward, you know, and sometimes it's a good lesson for us to learn just through kids alone. No matter what things are thrown in front of them, no matter how tough things get, and no matter how bleak things get, sometimes they're not aware of these things. They all are in the moment and thinking about trying to get to the next day. And I thought it was a really great, you know, human lesson there that we can learn from children, that we sometimes things get tough. We just have to keep moving on, and we have to go and dig deep within ourselves. And sometimes we need other people to help us get there. And I thought that was just a great human story in how these young kids are able to keep moving.
I loved the relationship between the two of them. The two actors just did such a great job. And am I right in thinking that they didn't have a lot of experience before they were in this film?
Yeah, no, they didn't have a lot of experience. I mean, they have done short films and smaller independent projects. And I was just taken away in the audition rooms by Skylin Brooks, who actually came in to audition the same day that Ethan Design, who plays Pete. They didn't know each other. They were there on the same day. And immediately I brought these two kids together. And one of the things that I learned as a filmmaker years ago when I was working, you know, like in a film like Men of Honor, when I was working with Robert De Niro, is that, you know, your actors is your partners. They're your partners in crime. You have to deal and work with these individuals for, like, the whole entire shoot. And you have to rely on one another and trust one another. And these kids, even though they were 13 and 8 years old at the time, they understood and was passionate about the movie and put every ounce of energy and talent and guts into the movie that they had. And I was blessed to have really tremendous great kids in this film. And they were my partners throughout the whole project.
The thing that I think struck me as a viewer is that I didn't feel that they were acting.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. And I think that is taking away the words and finding what's underneath and throwing the words out and really doing things through behavior. And I think that's what we learn as human beings, that we are who we are, not what we say, but what the things that we do. And they were able to understand that right off the bat, you know, just going to these particular areas and the projects and in Brooklyn and seeing a lot of kids who were left behind by parents, seeing kids who sometimes moms or parents had rehab, had issues with addiction, and they went away for a few days, a few weeks, or they get arrested, they left alone. They were able to have these conversations with these kids, and somehow the kids are able to see the behavior, the human aspects, sometimes because they don't judge. And I think they were able to really hone in on these behaviors and made it the movie feel real.
You talked about having actors as partners. The other thing that I think has been really important in your career is the importance of the script. And you mentioned that Michael Starbury wrote this. Normally, do you write your own scripts or are you open to getting scripts from other people?
I'm very open. I wrote my first two movies, my first independent, and then Soul Food was my second film. Really the first one that had distribution, Soul Food, and I wrote that, and that was based off my experience growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My grandmother lived on 10th and Burlite. Every Sunday we had Sunday dinners, and it was an interesting time how family were close through communication and through dinners and through, you know, keeping the tradition together. So that was a personal story, and I was able to write that personal story. But since then, I haven't did that much writing. I've just been concentrating on directing, so I've been always been open to reading other people's materials. Also, ironically, Men of Honor was written by Scott Smith, who actually grew up on the east side of Milwaukee. So he actually was a Milwaukee writer himself. So I actually worked with two writers from my same hometown. But just because of my writing skills and what I have done, I'm able to navigate through the material and see things a lot more clearly of what thematically what the story is trying to say. So it's been very helpful. And I'm always open to reading new material and hearing new voices.
I was just talking to a couple of the guys from The Dissolve, the new online film journal and criticism venture that's happening out of Chicago. And we were talking about sort of the state of film and the state of criticism. And one of the things they said was that they thought that Hollywood has just been having so much trouble making medium-sized and small movies that something like this wouldn't necessarily get a blockbuster release. Do you find working in the system as you are that it's difficult to get smaller projects? And by smaller, I mean it's relative, you know? I mean, it's not tiny, but it's certainly not, you know, a $100 million film.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, for this film to really see the light of day, I tried with the studios very early on, and nobody wanted to make the movie because this is, you know, it's a story that, you know, they felt like who would want to see movies about kids who struggle. And I kept saying, you know, this movie is an inspirational film, but at the end of the day, it's not a high concept blockbuster summer movie. And I kept saying that I really feel that people want to see human stories. So everybody passed on the material. So then you have to go out and find the money independently, which we did. And then you have to go through festivals to look for a buyer. And then the buyers are always looking at what is the marketing cost and how much money they will get back. So you're very limited to who will want to buy the film. The great thing about us, we were able to have Lionsgate, Summit, and Cold Black involved, who bought the movie and really wanted to get the film out there. So there's one of us, there's 20, 30 other films that never got to see distribution or have seen it in their very small release. At the end of the day, you know, you just have to keep making films and keep pushing. This year has been a remarkable year because films that they said would never really work, you know, like years ago, Jackie Robinson, 42, it was years in the making before they finally got that off the ground. And then when it comes out, you know, it's number one at the box office. So there's been a lot of cases like that this year where people are looking for personal stories. And hopefully that will start changing things.
How important are festivals like the Milwaukee Film Festival to directors like you and to directors in similar positions?
Oh, it's very important because, one, you get to see your film get to be seen by audience who truly love movies. These are, you know, audience who have traveled to see films, who have came from different cities to gather to promote filmmaking and storytelling. Also, as a filmmaker, give you a chance to meet other filmmakers. So as a filmmaker and a writer, you isolate it sometimes alone for many months writing and working on your own material. So give you a chance to see what other filmmakers are out there. I remember years ago at the Toronto Film Festival when Men of Honor was there, I got a chance to meet other filmmakers, Darren Aronofsky, who had a film out at that particular time, Joe Schumacher. You see a lot of, you meet other filmmakers, you gather relationships. And, you know, the fourth thing I think is very important is that it allows your film to get seen to have possible avenues for distribution or for television distribution as well. So festivals are very important. We have done several festivals for this film, and I think it's a great outlet. And it's such a great outlet that major studios now, you know, are placing their films. Films with releases coming up are placing their films because of the outlook to get the word of mouth out.
Okay, so they're actually using the film festivals themselves.
Exactly.
But, of course, you know, for the film goers like me, it's a great way to see stuff that you would never see otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's often great. I saw several films that I saw at Sundance this year, and it was awesome. And I'm waiting the films that I haven't seen. I'm waiting for them to be released. So it brushes you up as a filmmaker to see what else is out there.
One of the things I think, you know, people hearing this interview, and particularly aspiring filmmakers here, because there's a good film school at UWM, and there's a, you know, an animation program now that's at UWM and at MATC. What particular advice would you give to young filmmakers who are right here and want to go the distance?
I think the key is, you know, is really finding out what kind of stories that you want to tell and finding out yourself as a filmmaker. And I think an important key is to tell stories that are very important to you and write those stories. I never really considered myself a writer, you know, in terms of as a screenwriter. I just felt like I wanted to direct a film, and my only avenue of really doing that was writing. And the best way of writing was writing something that I know. And I really think that's the key, you know, is really getting to the direction of making movies and getting people to see your films. And if you're not a writer, and I just felt like I never felt like I was a writer. I just did it that one time just to open up the doors for me as a director, and it worked out. But and another avenue is if you want, you know, to make films, is you have so many avenues now. You know, you got digital filmmaking is changing, you know, the game, you know, and a lot of people are making films for lower and lower prices and for smaller budgets. And there's more outlets now because of social media. And I think it's very important if you want to be a filmmaker, make your films. If it's small films, short films, narratives, documentaries, make them. Now we don't have the excuse that it costs a lot of money to print 35 or 16 millimeter film. And all it takes is a good story. And I think that's the best advice I can give anyone. And as a filmmaker now, you constantly, you know, should always keep making movies and keep telling stories.
Well, George, it has been such a pleasure talking to you on the phone, and welcome back to Milwaukee in the good weather.
Thank you. All right, I look forward to being back.
Director producer George Tillman Jr. will appear Saturday evening at the screening of The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete at the Oriental Theater. The showing and talkback are part of the Milwaukee Film Festival, which is honoring the Milwaukee native this year. There's a link to the movie trailer and more about Tillman from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. A documentary showing at the Milwaukee Film Festival spotlights the work of a Madison researcher looking into the science of positive emotions. We'll learn about that work when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. We have spoken on this show before with Richard Davidson. His work at the University of Wisconsin is at the leading edge of the science of emotions. Davidson is the co-founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the university's Weissman Center. His work was spurred by a 1992 challenge from the Dalai Lama to apply science in studying positive qualities of the mind. That work, especially surrounding his study of meditation, is the subject of a film called Free the Mind that will be featured Monday at the Milwaukee Film Festival. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon reached Davidson from his office in Madison, and Davidson talked about how the science of meditation has evolved.
Things have really dramatically changed in the last 5 years in particular, but certainly there was a time when the thought of engaging in serious scientific research on meditation was really an oxymoron, and it was like oil and water. But that really has changed a lot, and we now have a conceptual framework in which to understand how these effects may arise, and that conceptual framework really comes from neuroscientific research on the nature of plasticity in the brain. The brain is an organ that changes in response to experience and in response to training, and it is through those changes that presumably the alterations in our experience and behavior that are produced by meditation occur. And modern research is teaching us that there are functional as well as structural changes in the brain that arise as a consequence of different kinds of meditation practice. This is really making it much more acceptable and a much broader range of the scientific community, I think, is quite open to this now.
What kind of involvement did you have with the subjects in the documentary?
Well, they were all participants in research that we were engaged in, so we had quite a bit of contact with them.
Okay, so you were able to follow them beginning to end from the documentary.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I just found the choices interesting. A boy who had a fear of elevators, and then contrasting with veterans returning. I think they were all Iraq War veterans. Any surprises, or were you fairly confident that they would all benefit from meditation?
Well, first, in terms of the juxtaposition of the work that we're doing with young children with the veterans who are coming back from the Middle East, that was a choice that was made by the filmmaker, and we really did not have any direct involvement in that choice. That was an artistic choice, and she felt that they really could be interestingly portrayed together. And I think my sense of it is that it really does work. In terms of your question about whether we had confidence that these procedures were going to work, there's certainly a lot of reason and background to suggest that they're reasonable to try. I don't think any scientist would think that these procedures are going to work in everyone. And in fact, one of the key questions in future scientific research is to better understand which kinds of practices work best for which kinds of people. Because I think the notion that one size does not fit all is certainly true of this area, as well as the looking at the impact of virtually any other kind of intervention on psychological or psychiatric processes.
One of the subjects, who was a Iraq War veteran, younger guy, he said that he has to keep busy all the time, that he cannot stop his mind. And I found that interesting. And it just leads, the question to me is keeping busy a form of denial, or is it a form of coping? Is it a form of both? And I think towards the end of the documentary, he actually started to benefit from it, from meditation.
Yeah, I mean, keeping busy is a form of distraction. That's something that I think many people use either implicitly or explicitly to sort of crowd out anxious thoughts and anxious feelings. If we're occupied with other activity, we pay less attention to what's going on inside. You know, that's why people get enjoyment from sort of mindless entertainment like watching television, because it does the same thing. It fills the mind with neutral kinds of activity that blocks out unwanted cognitive intrusions. The problem with those strategies is that they're all transient. They don't last. Once the distraction ends, the thoughts begin to re-emerge.
At one point in the documentary, you say you were very influenced by the visit from the Dalai Lama. Can you tell us how that, I'm not sure what your thoughts were before his visit on meditation, but did that have a transformation as far as your views on meditation?
Well, it's broader than that. I mean, I first met the Dalai Lama in 1992. He invited me to meet with him in his residence in India to discuss the possibility of doing research on individuals who've spent years transforming their mind through these kinds of practices. But the challenge that he really posed to me was this. He said, you've been using the tools of modern neuroscience to study qualities like anxiety and fear and depression. Why can't you use those same tools to study kindness and compassion and other kinds of positive qualities? And that was a very significant challenge, and one that I have very much taken to heart. And it's a challenge that really inspired us to take on this whole other realm. And it also relates to the conjecture that mental health is not simply the absence of mental illness. And so being able to alleviate certain symptoms is not the same as cultivating positive qualities of mind that may produce a kind of enduring well-being.
And the documentary didn't go into the spiritual side of this. I'm wondering what your thoughts are. People who don't really consider themselves religious or spiritual, I'm sure, could benefit from meditation, but can the two be separated?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what spiritual means. The way we approach meditation is from a scientific perspective. The Dalai Lama has encouraged us to use secular approaches to the teaching of these practices so that they are amenable and acceptable to individuals from any religious background, or for that matter, to atheists who have no religious convictions. And from a psychological and neuroscientific perspective, these are strategies to train the mind, and they should work independent of one's religious beliefs. So from our perspective, what we're doing really has nothing to do with religion, and it's compatible with any kind of religious tradition.
Maybe on its more basic level, the phrase was used in the documentary, calming the mind. That seems to be the theme of all of this.
Certainly, calming the mind is indeed an important theme. And these kinds of meditation techniques that are featured in the film can help individuals, we think, to calm their mind. And by calming their mind, we mean producing a trait, an enduring characteristic of equanimity, that fundamentally changes a person's relationship to their emotions and to adversity, so that it's not that negative emotions don't occur or worrisome thoughts don't occur, but rather they don't hijack a person. And so one's relationship to those thoughts or that adversity changes. And that's really what we're trying to get at with equanimity.
One of the parts of the documentary that surprised me the most is that kids, very young kids, I'm guessing they were five, six maybe, were...
Five.
They were five, okay.
Yeah.
And they were benefiting from meditation. They actually were able to just sit down calmly and meditate, which you don't normally associate with five-year-olds.
We've known about other efforts that are similar with children of this age, and there was every reason to think that if it was presented in an age-appropriate way, that these practices, in fact, can be adopted by children as young as five. And one of the things we know from modern neuroscience is that the brain is more plastic at that age. That's why children of that age can learn a second language more easily. That's why children of that age can learn to play a musical instrument more easily. We reason that if we can cultivate these healthy habits of mind in these very young children, we can instill the building blocks for positive developmental trajectory that can then have multiplicative effects as the children develop. And the kids really sort of naturally glommed onto this. And once they tasted in their own experience what this is like, there's a natural resonance. The children really very much enjoy being calm and enjoy the benefit comes along with it. And they want it more.
Well, it was a very interesting documentary. Richard Davidson, thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Richard Davidson is a professor of psychology and psychiatry and the founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His work is the focus of a documentary called Free the Mind, which will show Monday at the Milwaukee Film Festival. Davidson will also be on hand that night. You'll find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Friday's edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with the able assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster. And for the third time in recent weeks, we say farewell to another Lake Effect staffer, Amy Kiley, who leaves Milwaukee to take on afternoon drive time responsibilities in Orlando, Florida. Amy, we will miss you, but we'll think of you the next time we're wearing our Mickey Mouse ears. I'm Mitch Teich. Have a terrific weekend. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope we'll be part of your plan Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 with Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.